But the victory so far is that I remember even, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when one was writing about privatization, and it would just be a slew of insults in reply. But now the realization is there. How you fight the war remains. And I think that one of the things I really believe in is not the politics of government that should be addressed first, but for us, the politics of opposition, the politics of being a really difficult people that refuses to let this be done to us.
That's Arundhati Roy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Arundhati Roy and Eduardo Galeano on writers and resistance. Great writers since ancient times have delivered disturbing truths to the ears of the powerful. That tradition continues to the present. Harold Pinter of Britain may be the most eminent living playwright in the English-speaking world today. He was awarded the 2005 Nobel Prize for Literature. In his acceptance speech, he said, "The crimes of the United States have been systematic and constant, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide while masquerading as a force for universal good. It's a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. The invasion of Iraq was an act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law." Pinter's speech, widely covered in Europe and around the world, was barely reported on in the United States. Two writers who don't hesitate to challenge the official stories emanating from on high are Arundhati Roy and Eduardo Galeano. Arundhati Roy is the celebrated author of The God of Small Things, winner of the prestigious Booker Prize. The New York Times calls her India's most impassioned critic of globalization and American influence. Her latest books are An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire and The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile. Eduardo Galeano of Uruguay is one of Latin America's leading writers. His classic work is The Open Veins of Latin America. He's also the author of the award-winning Memory of Fire trilogy. His latest book is Voices of Time. Both he and Arundhati Roy are recipients of the Lenin Prize for Cultural Freedom. They spoke at New York's historic Town Hall on May 21st, 2006.
We finished all our talking backstage.
A little more interesting subjects.
What?
Iran.
Iran.
No. Iran. Oh, Iran, the country who dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah. Iran.
Iran. Iran is just Iraq with an N.
And the funny fact about all this tragedy is that Iran won the elections in Iraq. So it would be quite complicated to bomb it nowadays, I think. I don't know. I'm not an expert in doing these sort of things, but I would be quite doubtful about the results of it.
The thing is that, you know, every time something new comes, the old thing drops off the map. So we've all forgotten that Afghanistan is occupied, you know, Iraq is occupied. And, you know, these are countries that are occupied by the cruise missile. Then there are those that are occupied by the checkbook or what they call public diplomacy. But I think, you know, one of the real problems that all of us together face is that there'll never be any end to this chain of how many things we have to become experts on, you know, instant experts on the history of Iraq, history of Iran, history of Afghanistan. But really, what are our strategies of resistance? You know, what are we, how do we really stop this? You know, that is the real problem. How much do we want to stop it, and how do we stop it? Because I think that's eventually what I want to actually talk to Eduardo about. In Delhi, there's been a very public event unfolding, which was obviously something that I've been involved in for many years, which was the building of this dam and the displacement of many hundreds of thousands of people. But that's not the, I mean, the details are not what I want to talk about, but the fact that this was a nonviolent movement that has perhaps the biggest nonviolent resistance movement in India, which was just mocked and set aside, as so many nonviolent resistance movements are being today. And on the other hand, we have armed resistance, which is being crushed as well. So what I wanted to ask Eduardo from a, if I may quote you, you say that I have never killed anybody, it's true, but it's because I lacked the courage or the time, not because I lacked the desire. So,
this confession. No, but the fact is, like Arundhati says, that we share a lot of very important things, passions, hopes, doubts, fears, and we have been born in different countries, far away one from the other. But I think this is a proof that this international order called globalization is not the only possible organization of the world. The world is organized like a story I once heard in France. They said, it was a French friend of mine who told me years ago, he said it was a real story that really happened. I don't know. It's about the big chef of the world, the big chef, calling the hen, the dove, the turkey, the duck, and explaining them. I have called you because I want to ask you, with which sauce do you want to be eaten? And then, this is the freedom of choice. I mean, that... that we have in this so-called global world. But there is another world, here of a beautiful heritage of what was called in old times internationalism. Yeah. Internationalism, which holds the memory of the beginning of times when we were able to survive. It's impossible to explain the fact that, I don't know, thousands of or millions of years ago, I don't know, we were able to survive. We were so defenseless. I mean, the most defense invention of God or devil, I don't know. How could we survive? We survived because we were able to share our food and to be together, to defend together. And this heritage of solidarity is alive in the whole world and is explaining these identities we may find. It's true, we are twins. And there are lots of twins everywhere. I have just been in Seattle. I'm coming from Seattle. And there I met this Abe Asheroff, the character of them, the story I read in Spanish. He is a very brave man, and he was a member of the Lincoln Brigade, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. made from men and some women also who were able to mix for the first time in U.S. history black soldiers and white soldiers. There was a first time. Afterwards, in the Second World War, the order was reestablished, and then blacks were sent to death and to the kitchen and to death. But at that time in Spain, during the Lincoln Brigade experience, blacks and whites were fighting together. And they were not fighting for oil, big enterprises. They were not fighting in the name of the military industry. They were fighting because they believed in brotherhood. And that's it. That's it here also, not only in Latin America or in India, that there are so many people still believing that it's true, that we are so diverse and this is our best treasure, nuestro mejor tesoro, diversity, but that we are diverse and also we are one in the sense that we share so many horrors, but also so many marvels.
But I also think that the other thing is happening, being involved with a lot of on the ground political activity in India. One of the things that terrifies me, sometimes I think about it, is that is one always destined to fight on the side of people that have no space for you in their social imagination? You know, I always think, if the people I'm with win this battle, I'll be the first one that's strung up, you know? Because it's really a very complicated process where, let's say, the first, you know, the first part of even my life personally was spent battling tradition as a woman in India, you know, battling and hoping that I'm not going to end up marrying some man in the village I grew up in and getting beaten on weekends, you know. And to have fought that tradition, your own tradition, and escaped it, only to come up against a modernity which is so horrendous, is a very, very frightening thing. And if you look at who are the people who are waging the war, you know, whether it is in the name of Islam or in the name of former Stalinists or whatever, they are actually people are fighting, but maybe the dreams that you are dreaming are not the same, you know. So how do you negotiate that? It's a extremely difficult job, I think, to figure out how to pick your way down this path. Because I mean, to give you a small example, in the last 6 weeks, I've been in a place in Delhi now. Delhi is like a police city. Like, there's a little space that's designated for protests, and no one can go beyond the space or spill over without getting shot or arrested or whatever. So, you can't hear? Same here, yeah. Right. So, yeah, I saw the police, New York police yesterday, lined up to beat someone up. I don't know who they were going to beat up. But like, while you're there with a particular group of people, let's say the people that are being displaced by the dam. Now, this is not a political constituency, obviously. It's a constituency that's formed because they are being displaced by that reservoir. They may not agree with each other otherwise, you know. So, but many of those same people will be, I mean, they're fighting the dam, but maybe they are also you know, belonged to a right-wing Hindu party. Maybe they've also been involved in what happened in Gujarat with the Muslims. So how do you break these things down? It's very difficult to know. And then when power is against you, it invokes these divisions and it tries to divide things up. Even if you look at, I was on the war tribunal, the Iraq war tribunal, which was a wonderful exercise and a wonderful experience where you listen to testimonies and there was an analysis of the role of the media, of the role of, you know, all kinds of different people and governments and institutions in the prosecution of this war. And at the end, the jury had a very difficult question to debate, which was that we said we support the right of the Iraqi people to resist the occupation. And some people wanted to say we support the right of the Iraqi people to resist the occupation as per the Geneva Convention, which basically means that they don't have the right, as far as I can see, because you have this brutal occupation. Any kind of nonviolent resistance has been completely mowed down. Newspapers have been closed, demonstrators have been shot. So how do you resist this? And who's going to tell you what the rules are? And of course, brutal things are happening, you know? So I think one of our problems is that, you know, how far are we prepared? I mean, how pristine do we want to be? And how not, you know? And these are very knotty issues, even as writers, you know, to be involved in mass movements as I am constantly. Mass movements are also, have a sort of conservativeness to them. And, you know, someone like me isn't, you know, I'm always on the edge of it because you're not completely able to be that. And yet you support them.
So many contradictions and paradoxes. But this is life. I mean, life is contradictory. That's why life is moving on. Otherwise,
the thing is that at the same time Iraq remains occupied, you know? So
yes. No.
we have to stop that. We have to tell them to get out. You know? The soldiers have to stop fighting, the weapons have to stop going, the killing has to stop, you know, and we have to find a way of, and I think that responsibility is very much on the people in this country, that you have to find a way of stopping it, you know, because every day that it goes on is it's like a poison that's been injected into the bloodstream, just of society, but also of the rivers. The accounts we keep are so terrible. It's only about people, isn't it? Lancet Journal, 100,000 Iraqis and 2,000 Americans or whatever. But what about the animals? What about the rivers? What about the absolute desecration that is taking place? Even we are forced into a place where our own accounts are skewed. We don't take into account the earth or the water or the mountains or the... It's almost ludicrous if you begin to mention it, because the rest of the horrors are so huge, you know?
You know, I think we should be conscious that perhaps writing, I mean, our profession, our...
Love.
Life as passion, the passion of writing, has something to do with it in the sense that I think we are trying to integrate all these parts of a disintegrated world, and it's very difficult to do it, of course, For instance, I don't know, perhaps in India you are more lucky than in Latin America, but generally speaking, in Latin America, ecology is not a popular cause. I mean, people don't identify themselves with ecology at all. They want to get jobs. In Uruguay, for instance, we have so many thousands and thousands of jobless people. And so they prefer to die from contamination than to die from hunger. And I'm now, for instance, fighting in Uruguay with a very small group of people against the paper past plants. And but we are quite lonely. I mean, people, I will be denounced as a traitor to my country, traidor a la patria, because even our progressive government is receiving this as the best possible news, investments, they create jobs, and they are ruining the country. Certainly they were left dry land, poison air, ¿cómo era podrido? Rotten water, and it's very difficult to speak and convince people that will begin to say we need to work. So it's not easy. I mean, it's a very difficult job, and the same thing about human female rights, women's rights. And the same thing about a lot of other issues, because this is a very difficult world. When I was thinking, hearing what you said recently about the war and how we should fight against the war, perhaps trying even to explain to the makers of war that wars and walls, there are a lot of walls in the world nowadays. Some of them are mute walls because nobody speaks about these walls, but wars and walls are factories of terrorists. They are creating millions of terrorists. But then I realized that it was very stupid to tell this to the owners of our planet, because they build walls and they make wars because they need terrorists as an alibi for their big, huge, giant military machine. Otherwise, how can you explain the criminal fact, it's a scandal, that this world is spending $2,600 million each day in the military industry? How can you explain it without demons, without devils, without enemies? They are very in a shortage of enemies. They need enemies. They will begin publishing ads in the newspapers. enemies we need, no? In the part of employment, because this machine needs a justification. Otherwise, it would be impossible to sustain it. And then it's evident that, for instance, Iraq is creating a lot of terrorists. But this is the fuel they need, the oil they need to go on. And they have also some professional devils, like Bin Laden, who is a functionary, is clearly a bureaucrat of fear. He works creating fear, and so always ready, like the Boy Scouts each time. They need him, he's there saying, I'm going to eat all children crude in the world. He's a professional, but it's very complicated. I mean, it's quite a complicated subject.
Well, I think it's in terms of what is being thought of now. Of course, one part of it is the military-industrial complex and the fact that now the manufacture of weapons has outstripped the need for war. So you need to have wars in order to use the weapons and so on. But also, I think it is a form of, you know, what has happened is a hyper-capitalism, where it's a machine that's gone completely hysterical in terms of how it needs to generate profit. It can't stop itself. And so you have the whole concept of now full spectrum dominance, where in the papers of the CIA and so on, they've already said that this kind of neoliberal regime is going to create levels of inequality that can only be now controlled if you weaponize space. And this is, I mean, obviously the way it's happening in the kind of subcontracting of the people who are going to oversee this so-called war is not just, as I was saying earlier, it's not just the American government, but it's cohorts like in India now. And I think it's very interesting to read the open veins of Latin America now, because what is happening in India now is what happened in Latin America.
It's not a good prophecy.
Yeah, in the 70s.
No, but I think really, Arundhati, that it's difficult to build democracy inside one country in a world which is not democratic at all. I mean, this world is clearly not democratic. It's preaching, but not practicing democracy. We have. It's not only military occupation, of course, which is the most tragic expression of this crazy world as it is, but also other forms of occupation. The super government that's governing governments, especially in the south of the world. All these big scandals about the rise of crime, delinquency, the streets, and this hysteria is worldwide hysteria about safety. And, they would blame young people, especially young delinquents and poor people, of course, and blacks. But I'd ask, who are the models nowadays? I mean, these governments, super governments, over governments, who are telling us what we can do and what we cannot do, and what we should do, and they are deciding everything in the south of the world, even the speed of the flight of the flies, la velocidad del vuelo de las moscas, deciding absolutely everything. And you may see them. International Monetary Fund is managed by 5 countries. It's called international, but it belongs especially to one country who has the right of veto. And I don't remember the name of the country. and to other 4 countries. And the World Bank, other super institution, occupying countries, not in the military way.
You're listening to Eduardo Galeano and Arundhati Roy on Writers and Resistance. This is AR.
I think what's interesting is that in the 70s and a little earlier, the American government was busy toppling democracies because democracies were real threats, you know, in Latin America and so on. Now they've learned how to hollow out democracy and empty it of meaning. So even in America, when you have Bush and Kerry standing against each other, it's like choosing brands of washing soap, you know? Like, do you want... whether you buy this brand or that brand, they're both owned by Procter & Gamble or whatever, you know? So It's really an incredible system where they've hollowed it out. I know that the anti-war movement, for example, did support Kerry in the election, but he wasn't saying he was going to pull out the troops. So what did it mean, you know? When the elections happened in India 2 years ago, the Congress Party campaigned basically against the economic reforms. And you had television cameras in all these remote villages filming this great democracy and people coming on camels and bullock carts, and it was all very exotic to vote. The minute it became clear that the Congress was going to win the elections, those cameras were rushed out of the villages and outside the Bombay Stock Exchange. The stock market fell, and before you even knew who was going to be the prime minister, they had to come out and say, no, we are not going to change the privatization regime. No, we're not going to change anything. And it races on, you know.
So everything is possible and will be applauded as soon as you do exactly the opposite of what you have promised.
Exactly.
This divorce between words and facts, that it's working against the prestige of language and the prestige of democracy. You have seen in Latin America the scandal now, big scandal, because Evo Morales nationalized the oil. The oil and the gas.
And
like, terrible. Terrible. The world exploded.
And the same thing happened.
Why this scandal? Because he committed an unforgivable sin. He did exactly what he got promised to do.
Exactly.
And this is not democratic.
But I think the interesting thing here is that if you look at what we were talking about, internationalism, why is it eventually, you know, forget the wicked politicians. Look at even somebody like Nelson Mandela. What did he have to do? He became the hero of the anti-apartheid struggle, but the minute he came to power, he had to bow down to the IMF and to the World Bank. And why did it happen? Not because he's personally a bad person, but what whether it's India or whether it's South Africa or whether it's Brazil or whether it's Bolivia, there is this threat of capital flight. If you do this, we're going to pull out, your economy is going to collapse. So really, the internationalism has to come from these countries joining up. Because, you know, one of the good things about democracy for the establishment is, once again, democracy is within national borders, you know, whereas capital is outside it. You know, so you have a free flow of capital, but obviously you have policed nuclear borders, I mean, nuclear manned borders now. So unless there is a linking up of countries of the South, you're always under threat. The minute you take power, you're under threat. There will be capital flight. It's not worth just, you know, saying these are bad people, because there's a system in place that's causing this to happen.
And the problem is that for the youth, the new generations coming in the entire world, in India and Latin America, here in the States, everywhere, which are the models of success? Which are the images of virtue in a world that is rewarding lies, for instance? Lies about the Iraqi war. My poor mother used to say that lies have short legs, but it's not true at all. Lies have very long, long legs, and they run fast and fast. Faster than the liars, because when the liar said, no, it was an error, a mistake, nobody pays any attention, like in Iraq. But also in the democratic, so-called democratic elections in most of countries, we are trained to accept the fact that a politician is somebody clever enough to lie as if he was telling the truth. And it happens that there is now a crisis of faith in democracy all over the world, but especially among young people. For instance, even a sort of a model of democracy like Chile in the recent election, which had, I think, a very good result, which was the election of a woman. It's been time that we noticed that half of all of us are women. This so-called minority, I don't know why half of a population may be a minority, I cannot. But I'm not strong in mathematics. Perhaps that's why. So the result was good, but I was very anguished by the result also, because in Chile, 3 of each 4 young people didn't vote, 75%. 2,200,000 people didn't vote, all of them young.
But the point is, I mean, you know, when you have tide and ivory snow, then what's the point of voting? I also suffer from a crisis in faith, you know, in democracy.
Yes.
And I feel very, very, that's very, very important to have a crisis in faith in democracy, because democracy is not democracy anymore, you know.
Democracy should be democracy. The problem is that democracy is being betrayed by the professionals.
But it's just become the ceremony of democracy, elections.
Like a mass without God.
It's a meaningless ceremony.
It's a mass without God. It's true. But this is a challenge.
I think we should build
a new democracy, which is really entirely different. But there you have the problem of models and the superpowers who are really nowadays ruling countries, even in countries where democracy is more or less clean or possible. But if you have these superpowers imposing an international model which kidnap countries, rape nature, strangle salaries, and kill everything it touches, then how should you convince young people that they should follow a different track? They are the models of success. And so it's really a problem for all of us who really believe, I strongly believe, in the necessity of reopen new roads toward a real democracy. But quite
but
difficult.
I think that in a country like India, where there is the mass of people do live on natural resources and their fates are not tied up in jobs, but in access to water, in access to land, and access to natural resources. So there is a sense in which the mass of people completely and deeply understand that this is the wrong way to go. You know, so there is a big resistance building. The only trouble is that resistance is being mowed down. You know, it's being beaten down, whether it's nonviolent or whether it's an armed struggle. In both cases, it's been desecrated. But the victory so far is that I remember even, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when one was writing about privatization, and it would just be a slew of insults in reply. But now the realization is there. How you fight the war remains. And I think that one of the things I really believe in is not the politics of government that should be addressed first, but for us, the politics of opposition. The politics of being a really difficult people that refuses to let this be done to us. You know?
Ahora, now. I wrote a text. Strangely enough, it was closely linked to your last words. I don't believe in recipes, you know, recipes for social struggles or even the trying to define, if it would be possible to define it, the possible role of writers or these sort of things. But I wrote some suggestions. In dark times, I wrote, let's be skillful enough to learn how to fly in the darkness like bats. Let's be healthy enough to vomit the lies we are obliged to swallow each day. Let's be brave enough to have the courage to be alone, and brave enough to choose the risk of being together, because teeth have no use out of the mouth, and fingers make no sense without a hand. Let's be experienced enough to know that we may be compatriots and contemporaries of all who have a will of beauty and a will of justice, no matter where they were born or when they lived, because we don't believe in the borders of maps or time. Let's be stubborn enough to go on believing, against all evidence, that the human condition is worth the trouble, because we are badly done, quite wrong, but we are still unfinished. Let's be crazy enough to be called crazy, like the Argentinian Madre de Plaza de Mayo, the locas, the nuts, who refuse to forget in times of obligatory amnesia. And let's be clever enough to be disobedient. When we receive orders in contradiction with our conscience or against common sense.
I'm going to also read a little bit from an essay I wrote about India's nuclear tests in 1998. But before I do that, last time I was in New York, I was invited to be on the Charlie Rose show. So when I went there in the studio, he sat me down and said, I could tell that, you know, it was going to be a very aggressive interview. So he said, Arundhati, do you believe that India should have nuclear weapons? So I said, I don't believe that anyone should have nuclear weapons. I don't think India should have nuclear weapons. I don't think the US should have nuclear weapons. And I don't think Israel should have nuclear weapons. So he said, that's not what I asked you. I said, do you believe that India should have nuclear weapons? So I said, look, I don't think India should have nuclear weapons, and I don't think the US should have nuclear weapons, and I don't think Israel. He said, will you answer the question, should India have nuclear weapons? So I said, I don't think India should have nuclear weapons, and I don't. And then I said, look, can you explain to me why you're being so aggressive? I've answered your question. At which point, something collapsed, and he just looked stricken and said, but can you tell me what you think about world poverty or something? So anyway, the interview was never telecast. But this was written in 1998, which really marked a change in what happened, or the path that India has taken, you know, very, very seriously. Now that has been injected into its veins, the militarism, the nationalism, the communalism, it's all there, regardless of what government comes or goes. The desert shook. The government of India informed us, its people. The whole mountain turned white. The government of Pakistan replied. By afternoon, the wind had fallen silent over Pokhran. At 3:45 p.m., the timer detonated the three devices. around 200 to 300 meters deep in the earth, the heat generated was equivalent to 1,000,000 degrees centigrade, as hot as temperatures on the sun. Instantly, rocks weighing around 1,000 tons, a mini mountain underground, vaporized. Shockwaves from the blast began to lift a mound of earth the size of a football field by several meters. One scientist, on seeing it, said, "I can now believe stories of Lord Krishna lifting a hill." This was a quote from India Today. May 1998, it'll go down in history books, provided, of course, we have history books to go down in. Provided, of course, we have a future. There's nothing new or original left to be said about nuclear weapons. And there can be nothing more humiliating for a writer of fiction to have to do than to restate a case that has, over the years, already been made by other people in other parts of the world and made passionately, eloquently, and knowledgeably. But I'm prepared to grovel, to humiliate myself abjectly, because in the circumstances, silence would be indefensible. So those of you who are willing, let's pick our parts, put on these discarded costumes, and speak our secondhand lines in this sad secondhand play. But let's not forget that the stakes we are playing for are huge. Our fatigue and our shame could mean the end of us, the end of our children and our children's children, of everything we love. We have to reach within ourselves and find the strength to think, to fight. If only nuclear war was just another kind of war. If only it was about the usual things, nations and territories, gods and histories. If only nuclear war was the kind of war in which countries battle countries and men battle men. But it isn't. If there is nuclear war, our foes will not be China or America or even each other. Our foe will be the Earth herself, the very elements, the sky, the air, the land, the wind and water will all turn against us, and their wrath will be terrible. Our cities and forests, our fields and villages will burn for days. Rivers will turn to poison, the air will become fire, the wind will spread the flames. When everything there is to burn has burned, radioactive fallout would seep through the earth and contaminate groundwater. Most living things, animal and vegetable, fish and fowl, will die. What shall we do then, those of us who are still alive, burned and blind and bald and ill, carrying the cancerous carcasses of our children in our arms? Where shall we go? What shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we breathe? In early May 1998, before the bomb, I left home for 3 weeks. In New York, I met a friend of mine whom I have always loved for, among other things, her ability to combine deep affection with a frankness bordering on savageness. "I've been thinking about you," she said, "about the God of small things. What's in it, what's over it, under it, around it, above it." She felt silent for a while. I was uneasy and not at all sure that I wanted to hear the rest of what she had to say. She, however, was sure that she was going to say it. "In this last year, less than a year actually, you've had too much of everything. Fame, money, prizes, adulation, criticism, condemnation, ridicule, love, hate, anger, envy, generosity, everything. In some ways, it's a perfect story, perfectly baroque in its excess. The trouble is that it has or can have only one perfect ending." Her eyes were on me, bright with a slanting, probing brilliance. She knew that I knew what she was going to say. She was going to say that nothing that happened to me in the future could ever match the buzz of this, that the whole of the rest of my life was going to be vaguely dissatisfying. And therefore, the only perfect ending to the story would be death, my death. "You've lived too long in New York," I told her. There are other worlds, other kinds of dreams, dreams in which failure is feasible, honorable, sometimes even worth striving for, worlds in which recognition is not the only barometer of brilliance or human worth. There are plenty of warriors that I know and love, people far more valuable than myself, who go to war each day knowing in advance that they will fail. True, they are less successful in the most vulgar sense of the word, but by no means less fulfilled. The only dream worth having, I told her, is to dream that you live while you're alive and die only when you're dead. Which means exactly what? I tried to explain, but didn't do a very good job of it. Sometimes I need to write to think. So I wrote it down for her on a paper napkin. And this is what I wrote. To love, to be loved, to never forget your own insignificance, to never get used to the unspeakable violence and the vulgar disparity of life around you, to seek joy in the saddest places, to pursue beauty to its lair, to never simplify what is complicated or complicate what is simple, to respect strength, never power, above all, to watch, to try and understand, to never look away, and never, never to forget. Thank you.
That was Arundhati Roy and Eduardo Galeano on Writers and Resistance. They spoke at New York's Town Hall on May 21, 2006, at an event organized by the Lannan Foundation and the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. Arundhati Roy of India is the celebrated author of The God of Small Things, winner of the Booker Prize. Her latest books are An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire and The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, a collection of interviews I did with her. Eduardo Galeano of Uruguay is one of Latin America's leading writers. He's the author of The Open Veins of Latin America and The Memory of Fire trilogy. His latest book is Voices of Time. Both he and Arundhati Roy are recipients of the Lannan Prize for Cultural Freedom. This program is produced by AR, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR, celebrating 20 years, is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Amy Goodman, Arun Gandhi, Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, Tariq Ali, Gore Vidal, and Howard Zinn. To access our vast audio catalog, including our Arundhati Roy archive and the book, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, and to find out about subscribing to AR, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Allie Lightfoot edited the program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. We go out with music from Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan of Pakistan, performing a ghazal by the great Urdu poet Iqbal. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Dalari 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 dal